Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open the committee on the Senate health care. It is 1 o'clock and hearing room B, and I would like to open, is there any introduction of committee bills? Okay. I would like to open an informational meeting on fair health, and Oliver, would you let us know who is on the phone so that we can say hello to them?
Great, Oliver Duffers. Folks on the phone with Fair Health, can you please introduce yourselves?
Certainly. My name is Robin Gilbert, president of Fair Health. I'm joined here by Michelle Scott, our general counsel, and Ali Russo, our chief information officer.
Okay, and let us call up Sharif. Zafran, and who else comes up? Hans Notenboom, and you're going to run the, and can answer questions too. Okay, so I need to know who's going to go first. Okay.
Folks on the phone.
Okay, so the folks on the phone, I'm not sure which one, please start us off.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, as I said, my name is Robin Gilbert. I am president of Fair Health, a national, independent, not-for-profit organization. I'm here to provide informational testimony about Fair Health, and we are not here to take any position on the pending legislation. We've provided informational testimony for lawmakers in a number of other states as they have been weighing balanced billing legislation. I know we have submitted already a written statement as well that can be referenced, and I believe you have a copy of our slide presentation, and I will be happy to refer to the number of the slide that I'm speaking from. And obviously, we're here to answer your questions, so feel free at any point to interrupt me and move in the direction that's most meaningful for you. Going to slide three, just to let all of you know who may not be familiar a little bit about Fair Health in terms of our mission. We were created out of an investigation by the New York Office of the Attorney General back in 2009 because there were concerns about the way out-of-network reimbursement was being adjudicated, and they felt that there were impermissible conflicts of interest in the company that was disseminating data products to the insurance industry. Everyone agreed that the matter should be settled and that a new, independent, not-for-profit should be created that could bring integrity and transparency to the marketplace with our data repository of healthcare claims that were evaluated, audited, and reviewed and aggregated with the best thinking of statisticians and economists and methodologies and algorithms that have been tested in the marketplace. We also were tasked with creating a free consumer platform to provide consumers with access to healthcare cost information, as well as to make our data available to policymakers and academics to help support health systems research and help all ask and answer questions involving the healthcare industry without, and from our perspective, without bias or judgment. Slide four, as you can see, some of these names may be familiar to you. They are governed by an independent board of directors who are uncompensated, who are nationally recognized in their field, and they come from policymaking, government, academia, the physician world, as well as law and consumer representation as well. Slide five will give you a sense of what we have in our repository. We currently have over 22 billion records, both medical and dental combined, which represents the healthcare claims experience for approximately 150 million covered lives from around the country. The data are organized into 493 different geographic regions we call geozips, which tend to track with the first three digits of the zip code. We have representation for all 50 states, the District of Columbia, as well as Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Virgin Islands. Our data come from approximately 60 national and regional payers, as well as third-party administrators. The data reflect both fully insured claims as well as self-insured claims. And when we receive the data, which comes in on an ongoing basis, it is subjected to a very rigorous quality testing and control protocol. Slide six. So just putting a spotlight on Oregon, from 2002 to the present, we have approximately 136 million claims. And with respect to 2015 alone, that would be approximately 26 million. We have claims from 50 different contributors who reflect services rendered in Oregon, and 26 of those have submitted 10,000 records or above. It's been, in aggregate, our data represent approximately 50% of the healthcare claims in the state. Slide seven. This just basically reflects a lot of the BI tools, the sophisticated methodologies that we have developed to really evaluate the data to make sure that we're comfortable in that it contains all of the requisite information, that there are not improper procedure codes or zip codes, so on and so forth. Slide eight, again, just gives you a flavor for the ongoing data auditing and validation that's undertaken upon receipt of any data contribution file. Slide nine, we were very, very proud to have been designated as a qualified entity in 2016, one of only four in the country, which now allows us to receive all of Parts A, B, and D Medicare data for all 50 states. With that data, we are required as a QE to issue public reports regarding provider performance and experience. And in addition, that data can enrich our own products and be combined with our commercial data. Slide 10. So two really significant things with respect to the investigation. Even though it was a New York investigation, in effect it gave rise to a national remedy because the data that we received from Ingenix, which was the company that was being investigated, which is now Optum, had data on all 50 states and had relationships with vendors, with payers and other stakeholders outside of New York. And in effect, we stepped into those shoes and really began to bring transparency and the quality of our products across the country. So, as I said, the New York investigation became national, and likewise, while it originally focused on out-of-network adjudication of claims, so many different stakeholders were concerned with having an independent, robust data source to help support their decision-making. We began to support stakeholders really in all parts of the healthcare ecosystem. Page 11 gives you a flavor for how much the purposes of the data have proliferated from when we first became operational. So in addition to supporting out-of-network adjudication of claims, our data are also used to help frame in-network fee schedules, to help do premium rate review, to support reimbursement reform, whether it's ACO or bundled payment modeling or reference pricing, to do market research, strategic planning, epidemiological research, payment integrity questions, and so on and so forth. Slide 12, as you can see, as an independent not-for-profit unaffiliated with any insurer and operating without bias, a number of states started approaching us, reaching out to see if we can support their various state health-related programs. So in many states, we serve as the basis for their workers' comp fee schedules, their auto liability fee schedules, their dispute resolution programs, supporting their state health insurance plans, also serving as a reference point for emergency services in the California Healthcare Code. Likewise, the Medical Indemnity Fund in New York uses us to support adjudication of claims for neurologically impaired newborns. Arizona uses us for dental claims for their pediatric population. And of course, several states now, you know, New York and Connecticut, have integrated us, as you can see in slide 13, New York was out of the gate in 2014 with a consumer protection law that addressed both surprise out-of-network bills and emergency services. It became effective in March 2015, so now has been in effect for about a year and a half. And as you probably know, they included in their statute a codified term called usual and customary costs, which if you go to slide 14, that was defined as the 80th percentile of an independent database unaffiliated with any insurer. Fair Health was deemed the only database that met that definition. And what UCC does for New York, it is not that payers are required to reimburse at that level, but plans and providers are encouraged to negotiate and come up with an equitable amount using that UCC benchmark as sort of a backdrop to those conversations. And then if they cannot agree, there is a dispute resolution process that expressly authorizes the dispute resolution entity to refer to UCC to help resolve that particular reimbursement.
Okay, Ms. Gilbert?
And the consumer, yes?
Yes. We only allow 20 minutes, and I notice you have 48 slides here. So we need to. We're halfway through what you should be presenting, and I'm wondering. I just want to make sure everyone had a chance to speak to this.
I would stop at slide 21. I think that gets to the balance goes to the ways in which we are, referencing. The publications and all, and that you can look at your leisure, and I think, it's been summarized. I would stop in about five slides, which I think gets you some of the heart of the questions you're dealing with in comparing Fair Health to Medicare data, and then I would be happy to take your questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So as you can see, slide 15, Connecticut went in a slightly different direction. They actually focused solely on emergency services, not surprise, out of network, but they did prescribe reimbursement at a certain level, which would be best of three, the in-network amount, Medicare, or the 80th percentile of an independent database. Again, Fair Health was selected as that database. Slide 16 just references the fact that, many, many states have been exchanging, have reached out to Fair Health, asking us for webinars, in-person presentations, written testimony to help them advance their thinking about the solution that might be right for their state. Slide 17 just shows the list of some of our products. I just draw your attention. The medical surgical module that's listed there is charge data that goes through rigorous outlier methodologies, excluding the high and the low of the data that we receive. The allowed medical is the negotiated amount, the contract amount that's typically used in an in-network setting. And so we've been asked questions about both charge data as well as the allowed. And if you go to 18, it's true with both the charges and the allowed, there's not one specific percentile. Sometimes people misunderstand, and when they hear about Fair Health, they think there's one Fair Health number. We have an array of percentiles, and states tend to pick one that is best for their jurisdiction to meet their particular needs, whether it's, again, whether it's allowed or charged, that's really the state's choice. And likewise, what percentile they may choose, the 40th percentile, the 50th, there's no sort of magic percentile that is particular. And that goes to slide 19, meaning we do not set UCR. We take no position on what percentile would be the appropriate reference point. We're just happy to provide robust, rigorous data that could help reflect the particular benchmark that's of importance to the state. Slide 20, again, just shows how we are often used by government officials as well as policymakers to do a wide range of research into whether it's the Affordable Care Act or whether it's looking into reimbursement design or syndromic surveillance. So let me stop here at slide 21 because a number of states that have reached out to us have asked us, so how does really Fair Health and Medicare differ? Because we're really sort of evaluating different options here. Well, there are a couple of things. One, in terms of geography, Fair Health tends to be rather granular in its geographic composition. As I mentioned, we have 493 geo-zips in total. Medicare has 90. In Oregon, we have 5 GeoZips dedicated there, whereas Medicare would only have 2. The methodology is very different. We base our data on actual charges in terms of the charge benchmarks, and then in terms of the allowed amounts, again, it's drawn from actual transactions that are then put through a very rigorous methodology, and that's de-identified. We, to the extent that there are low frequencies with respect to any one procedure, then we use an imputed methodology that has been developed with statisticians and economists and is now at the patent office. In terms of the Medicare fee schedule, all of their data is based on relative values and conversion factors set by the various RUC committees. They have then geographical adjustments based on the gypsy areas they've configured. And as you can, as you know, Medicare was created to support the disabled and the elderly. It was not really intended as a general health fee schedule, and therefore has a number of gaps that do not support all of the services that might be covered or needed by the state. Also, in terms of fair health, our task was to really provide an accurate and transparent mirror to the healthcare market in general, both allowed data as well as charges. Medicare, was created as a government fee schedule by the federal government to advance certain policies, and you can argue in favor or against those policies, but it is a policy-driven fee schedule based on certain budgetary parameters. And so it's not, there are some winners and losers in that. Some specialties may be closer to the market, whereas others may not be because it may not align with what the Medicare policies underlying them are. Whereas the allowed data and our charge data both proportionally relate to what has been happening in the marketplace.
Okay.
So let me stop there and take your question.
Well, I would like, since we only have about 3 minutes left, I'd like for the speakers that came to testify to please give your testimony.
Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us to come in and speak. My name is Sharif Zafran. I'm the one of the executive board members with the Physicians for Fair Coverage, representing about 600 physicians here in the state of Oregon. I also serve as the American Society of Anesthesiologists chair on the task force on out-of-network payment. We've offered some written testimony to touch on the more complex issues around out-of-network payments and surprise billing. What I wanted to really touch on is going along with what Robin's been talking about with Fair Health around benchmarks and so forth. One of the things that's important for all of us to understand is that this is a very complex issue, and one of the unintended consequences of complex issues is simple solutions that drives a lot of unintended consequences. With the advent of the Affordable Care Act, not because of it, but with it, we've seen a lot of design products from insurance carriers that narrow networks significantly and also tier networks, tiering basically meaning that you have platinum plans, bronze plans, and gold plans. And with those plans, a lot of providers have been pushed out of network, not by their choice, but by product design. So within the last several years, we've seen this whole idea of surprise bills and a component of it being out-of-network bills rise from that standpoint. But the other side, of course, is with these really large deductibles that have been part of these new product designs and very large copays, the surprise bills have been a conglomerate of both high deductibles, copays, and, of course, out-of-network payments. And we found that in the vast majority of them, the high deductibles and the high copays have been a vast majority of that. But from the standpoint of a lot of our patients being surprised by providers who thought they were in network, not being in network, is to provide a mechanism of the patients being held harmless in that type of scenario and giving them a mechanism or giving everyone a mechanism to be able to get some type of payment that would not allow for a balanced bill. And that's where the idea of Fair Health came in, which was designed and brought about as a result of that lawsuit, as Robin had mentioned, back in 2009 with that company called Ingenix, which was actually a subsidiary of United Healthcare. And they were setting those minimum benefit standards way below market value. So Fair Health was created as a result of that. And the idea was that if you use the 80th percentile of Fair Health, you're essentially excluding the top 20% of the charges in the marketplace that we would consider the outliers. So you're really coming to a number that is much closer to what the negotiated, discounted, in-network work rates would be. You know, still allowing for that tension to allow for a negotiated rate between providers and between insurance carriers. But again, at the end of the day, we wanted to make sure that that mechanism allowed for patients not to be caught in the middle. That in instances where all of us are surprised by being out of network, sometimes I'm surprised that, you know, I'm in network with all the carriers out there, but there's one specific product with one specific carrier that I may not be in network with. And if all of us are surprised from that standpoint, then what is the mechanism of having a payment that the patient does not have to get surprised by some kind of bill? And that's where the Fair Health mechanism comes in. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, because again, I know there's a lot of information that kind of ties into all that.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Hans Notenboom. I'm an emergency physician. I work out of Eugene, and I'm the current president of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And I know we're pressed for time, so I will make it a more high-level view. And I think that I would like to say that we think of this often from the patient's perspective, and I can only say that it's not a comfortable feeling for a patient to have to be thinking about these plans, what level am I? It's a very complicated situation in an emergent situation. Due to EMTALA laws, we take care of all people from all places in all situations all the time. And we often do so in a very emergent and acute situation where we don't have time to think about all these things. What we would like to avoid is to have patients caught in the middle, as you've just heard. And we think that having a benchmarking that's transparent and fair while also allowing for a reasonable reimbursement rate will continue to give patients in Oregon the best access to emergency care. If we don't do this correctly, we run the risk, I think, potentially of having difficulties with access if people find that they're taking large losses, and especially in the rural areas, I think, but also with call panels and other people who take emergent call for these patients as well in the larger cities. So I think our main take-home message would be we support this transparent method. We think it's fair, and we want to consider the patient at the center of this and taking the patient out of this difficult situation.
Wonderful. Any quick questions? Thank you very much. This is a topic that needs a whole lot more discussion than what we have had today, but I want to thank you all and those on the phone, too, for coming. With that, I'm going to close the informational... Yes?
No, there was an echo.
Oh, my echo. Sorry. I'll close the informational hearing on Fair Health, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 235, carried over from Tuesday. The measure creates a statewide tobacco retail licensing program. The measure requires the Department of Revenue to enter into agreements with the Oregon Health Authority and local public health authorities to oversee enforcement of laws, ordinances, and rules of the program.
Great. Let's have Deanna Mack, Karen Gerard, and who was the other one that wanted to come up first? Yeah.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess, already. Madam Chair.
How time flies.
I know, right? Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I apologize. My testimony was not, it was somewhat rushed on Tuesday because of some other things. So I'm here today, again, to talk about the reasons why the Department of Revenue wants to have this particular tobacco retailer licensure component. So currently, the tobacco tax and other tobacco product laws require indicia to be a stamp to be placed on the packaging. And so we have inspectors that go around the state and look for non-compliance with tax laws, make sure that the invoices match the product, that they have tax paid on it, and that it's not untaxed product or considered contraband in the state. So licensure for us would provide an accurate database of current retailers that are selling cigarette and tobacco products in the state. We have an idea of who they are, but when whenever you raise the tax rate, we have what's called a floor tax. And in the retailers, we have to notify them and tell them, look, you have to go out onto your floor and take an inventory of everything you have and pay the difference between the current tax rate and the new tax rate all in one fell swoop. And so it helps us to help to administer our floor taxes when we have them. It helps us in planning tax compliance inspections to make sure that we're going to all of the places in the state, making sure all locations are licensed and there's not untaxed product in those locations. And it also provides additional tools for us for enforcement. Right now, the current law only allows us to impose civil penalties of up to $1,000. And there's no sanctions for non-payment of those penalties or repeated non-compliance. So giving a license gives us authority to then revoke or suspend the license for non-compliance with the tax laws of the state. In this bill, it also allows for revocation for public health violations as well. But for the department, we would be able then to go to a location that doesn't have a license or and have some consequences, or that they do have a license and have untaxed product, and we can seize that product, we can revoke the license. There's additional measures if that is in place. So it would help us with the administration of the tax component as well. So I hope I've made that more clear for you than I did on Tuesday.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how much, I'm not asking this right, talk to me about the way you're enforcing the law now. How often do you visit these things, and what does that enforcement process look like currently?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, we have staff of compliance specialists that go around the state and do random inspections of retailers. It's not like an audit where we call them up and say, prepare your records and we'll be there in a few weeks or talk to you, but we actually go out and inspect to make sure that they do have, they are complying with the law. I haven't looked at statistics recently, but I believe we get to about 1,200 a year inspections, and I think we have a base of retailers at somewhere around 4,000. So we're kind of cycling through that, but we're not entirely sure. I think this bill also expands it to vaping retailers as well, so that would increase, I want to say, a few hundred retailers in that pool of people that we would inspect as well if the tax were to later apply to those products. I know there's other bills and other committees that are talking about that very thing, so it would help us with the administration of that if the legislature were to pass those types of taxes as well. Does that help answer your question?
It is. May I follow up? Have you ever explored doing an intergovernmental agreement with OLCC, which is already out in a lot of those places?
Boy, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, I would have to check with our program staff, but I know that we are currently coordinating resources with our marijuana tax program and inspections. We do use the information between agencies, but I don't know if we have an interagency agreement between us, if it's confidential or not. I know our tax return information is confidential, but I'm not so sure it's the other way around. I'd have to check with program staff to find that out, but I can follow up.
So your piece is very different from the enforcement from the Oregon Health Authority and the counties, and that's what I want to make sure we differentiate it, because mm-hmm. the licensing for you will help you know who are the retailers who sell these products, and so that you can make sure, explain a little bit about the income tax reporting.
The Madam Chair, the tobacco tax is, I think right now it's $1.32 a pack. I think it's scheduled to go to $1.33. It's another penny. There's that, and then there's the tax on the other tobacco products, like the moist snuff, and there's a limit on that. Cigars, they all have taxes on them. So we have to enforce and make sure that the retailer or the tax has been paid on that product to ensure compliance with, you know, obviously the revenue streams that you rely on for funding programs. So we do actually do those inspections, and we do then later audit on the back end. We have some folks that actually audit the returns for the veracity of them to make sure that they're correct. We have some staff, I believe, that do some filing enforcement as well to say, look, the Jenkins Act under federal law, where they have sold online, they've purchased product online and brought it into the state, and there's a use tax on that. That the person who purchased online is supposed to pay the cigarette tax to the state, and if they don't, the Jenkins Act requires that these sellers tell us, they send us invoices, and then we'll do some enforcement on that and send bills to folks who didn't pay the tax. So that all of these things are components of the program, but this particular part is the biggest part of it, is the retailers and the people who sell it in the state.
And before we go to OHA, because I know you have to go testify somewhere else, tell how this is being dovetailed with what OHA, Oregon Health Authority, is proposing in the
county. Okay, in this bill, what the proposal would be is that the Oregon Health Authority and the local public health authorities, I get the terminology right, would have their licensing programs or requirements, ordinances, but we, Department of Revenue, would manage the licensure program, and we would collect the fees on behalf of those entities and then distribute to those entities to help them do their public health enforcement. Does that answer your question? So we would coordinate the statewide licensure. The fees would vary depending on the locality, which is basically in our system kind of a table driven thing that we could track, and then we would collect that receipt from them and then move it on. There's some finer nuances about whether we know that they're in compliance with the local ordinances or not. So there's a couple of different models that we can do through interagency agreement we've talked about. One is we just give them the license, and then they tell us on the back end that the person is not in compliance with their ordinances, and then we can do a revocation or suspension of the license if necessary. Or the alternative is to model it after the marijuana tax program, which requires the person to go to the local government and get for marijuana, it's called a land use compatibility statement that they have to attach to their application and bring it in all at once. So on the front end, we could do something like that where they go to the local government and get a I'm in compliance with the whatever ordinances they have, and let us know that before we issue the license. So there's those two ways, and I think that's pretty flexible in here for us to be able to work through those finer nuances. But yeah, that's kind of the plan if this bill were to pass.
Okay. Any questions for her? Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Ma Sanderson, members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard. I'm the Health Promotion Manager for the Oregon Health Authority. And I won't go over my written testimony that's been submitted because a lot of it was covered on Tuesday, but I would like to stress that tobacco use generally starts in adolescence, and it's cheap, readily available, and easy to get for kids. And that is the retail environment is a very important environment for marketing to kids and availability of these products, and it's a very important area for us to have retail licensure. Licensing system is a key mechanism for monitoring and enforcing current and future laws to reduce the number of Oregon children and young adults that become addicted to tobacco, to help current tobacco users quit, and to reduce the health care costs for the state of Oregon. We really appreciate the opportunity to participate in the discussion of how this legislation would fit together with the Department of Revenue and local public health authorities, and would like to stress that the enacting policies at the local level is really important so that communities can, within their communities, develop solutions that fit best for their values and meet their needs. Local public health authorities have the relationships within their communities to work with businesses and to enforce laws. The role of the state, the Oregon Health Authority, would be to help coordinate training, technical assistance, and compliance across the state. But really, enforcement at the local level is key to success. And just one thing I did want to clarify from Tuesday, any federal funds related to enforcement of federal tobacco laws are strictly limited to the monitoring and enforcement of federal tobacco laws and cannot be used in any way for Oregon state tobacco laws at all.
I forget who was the one from Bend who testified last time.
Suzanne Kelso.
Say it for the record.
Suzanne Kelso.
Suzanne Kelso was here, and she mentioned federal funds that are made available for enforcement, and I'm wondering how those funds are being used right now, because she's saying that this is unnecessary because we have those funds.
Chair Monis Anderson, the federal funds that are available to states for enforcement are strictly for enforcing federal tobacco laws and cannot be used for enforcing state or local tobacco laws. The Oregon Health Authority would coordinate those inspections from the Oregon Health Authority so that to reduce as much duplication and as possible, but those funds are strictly limited to addressing federal tobacco.
Thank you, Anderson. Can you be a little more detailed about that? I'm not sure that I understand what the difference is between what the federal law restrictions that you would be enforcing versus mm-hmm. what new requirements we're talking about with licensing. And you said coordinates with whom? Mm-hmm. Who does the actual inspections or stings, whatever you want to call them?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Beyer, there are three tobacco enforcement programs. They are all coordinated out of the Oregon Health Authority, but each one has very specific limitations. The FDA enforcement is limited to enforcing the federal Tobacco Act, and it has to do with some product placement, sales to minors. There is a lot of overlap, but it is very limited to those laws. The inspections take place obviously at a local level, and the enforcement is done from the FDA. Then there is the SINAR inspection program, and that is not an enforcement program, but it is the sales to minors check to see how we're doing for having retailers sell to minors, and that is the important rate that we're judged on for our federal block grant funding, and one that we've worked very hard to get down, the one that Senator Steiner Hayward's daughter was working on. And then we have the state tobacco enforcement program, and that is where we have more flexibility in Oregon to enforce our state tobacco laws. But we have to have that program in place for the SINAR program. It's very confusing, and but all three are coordinated out of the Oregon Health Authority so that we can make sure that we are not duplicating efforts when we visit retailers.
So who actually does the inspections or the enforcement activity?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Beyer, it depends on the inspection program, but the FDA inspectors must be commissioned by the FDA to do those FDA inspections.
So are they federal employees?
Currently, they are the only entities in Oregon who are able to do that, to be commissioned. State employees who are able to do that are state police. The SINAR inspections, we have an interagency agreement with the Oregon State Police to conduct those inspections, as well as our state tobacco inspections. So the Oregon State Police are able to do all three programs, but they have to be documented and implemented separately.
But then we have another just with Multnomah County. So I'm wondering, are we having four different people doing now four different inspections, because Multnomah County has theirs, and then we have the police, but is police complaint driven?
Chair Monis Anderson, thank you for reminding me about the important local enforcement that might be occurring, like in Multnomah County, where they do have their own tobacco licensure program. Again, having the Oregon Health Authority coordinate with local public health authorities, as well as these required state inspections, we are able to make sure that retailers should generally only be visited once in a year unless there is a complaint or that they'd had a previous violation. But we are coordinating all of that together.
So where does that standard come from?
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Bright, the standard for...
Can only be visited once. Oh. Is that state law? Is that part of the federal grant requirement?
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Beyer, it is our intention at the Health Authority to work to make sure that retailers are only visited once unless there's some extenuating circumstances that they'd be visited more than once. That was the intention of having all of the programs consolidated at the Oregon Health Authority and coordinated from there because, as you've indicated, there are lots of different inspection programs and could be tripping over each other. And so to minimize that, consolidating it at the health authority will help that.
Sorry, I want to make sure I understand. So the three federal programs, I guess you were talking about, are those block grants that come to the health authority that you then have the option of contracting with someone else to do?
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Beyer, there are two federal programs, the SINAR program and the FDA program, and those are funds that are available to the Oregon Health Authority, and we do subcontract through an interagency agreement with the Oregon State Police. The state tobacco enforcement is a state program that we also contract with the state police to do.
And the requirement is that under the FDA is that the inspectors have to be a sworn officer?
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Beyer, yes. The FDA requires that people who do inspections are commissioned by the FDA. Senate Bill 235 does provide a technical fix that is important for us so that it is not limited to only the Oregon State Police who can be commissioned officers of the FDA, but would allow employees of the Oregon Health Authority as well.
And the commissioning requirements on the FDA?
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Beyer, I'd have to get you that information.
I appreciate seeing that.
Okay. Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. The Department of Justice works in conjunction with the Department of Revenue and Oregon Health Authority to work on enforcement issues. With me today is Assistant Attorney General Kristen Gilman, who's our expert in this area, and I'll let her kind of get into a little bit more detail. But just wanted to say the Department of Justice joins the chorus in support for Senate Bill 235. We would request the Dash 2 amendment. It basically just allows the Department of Justice to access the information that the Department of Revenue will be getting so we can coordinate our enforcement. So with that, if I can, I'll turn it over to Ms. Gilman.
And per that question, have OHA looked at that amendment, and do you have problems with it?
Chair Moss Anderson, we have reviewed that amendment and have no problems with it.
Thank you, Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Gilman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I work on tobacco enforcement issues for the department. One of our programs is that we maintain two directories. We have a directory for cigarettes and roll your own tobacco, and a separate directory for smokeless tobacco products. And manufacturers certify with our office, and we review and make sure that they're in compliance with state and federal laws related to the manufacture of these products, and then we publish a directory. And that directory is publicly available, and distributors and retailers get updates of it, and they are not permitted to sell products that are not listed in our directory. We work closely with the Department of Revenue to enforce that, especially at the retailer level. The Department of Revenue testified about their inspector programs. We utilize their inspectors. One of the things that they're looking for when they're in the field is, in addition to the whether there's taxes are paid is whether the products were legal for sale per our directory. And I have an investigator who periodically goes out with them. She doesn't go on every inspection, but once a month or so she goes out to put her eyes on and make sure that retailers are in compliance. So for the reasons stated by the Department of Revenue and the Health Authority, we agree that retail licensing is important and would be helpful to our program as well.
So do you have vaping is not a tobacco product, so you don't do anything with the vaping industry. Is that correct?
That is correct. At this time, our statutes do not cover vaping products. It's only cigarettes, roll your own tobacco, and then the smokeless tobacco products.
Okay. Hmm. Thank you, ma'am. Just a curiosity question. Since all legal or all tobacco products that are sold in the state have to have a state stamp on it, I assume that any product that you wouldn't have a stamp on something that wasn't on the state list.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Beyer, that's true with respect to cigarettes. Cigarettes have to be stamped. That's for roll your own tobacco and smokeless tobacco. Those are taxed as other tobacco products, which are not stamped on the distributor pays tax based on the wholesale price. And the law is that they aren't supposed to be stamped if they're not on the directory. And for the most part, we've seen compliance with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Sean Miller, Matt Minahan, and Joseph Gilpatrick.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. And we are currently opposed to Senate Bill 235. Last session we spent a lot of time working on, then it was Senate Bill 1559, to create a statewide retail tobacco licensing program, which would also preempt the local governments from enacting their own licensing programs, as well as any kind of restrictions on pharmacy and location bans. And, you know, we spent a lot of time on that because Multnomah County was obviously working on their they had passed an ordinance, and they were holding off to see if a statewide ordinance was passed, and it did not pass. However, the bill before you today, you know, goes in the opposite direction of what we worked on last session. And again, you know, I want to emphasize a statewide program. My client, the grocery industry, supports a statewide licensing program. We agree that if there is a program in place to keep underage from obtaining these tobacco products, that we can support this. However, this particular bill is not a statewide program. And I just want to point on page 7 of the bill, when it talks about on lines 10, it does give the authority, the health authority, to look, you know, to work with local public health authorities to establish, administer, and enforce these programs. But if you look down on line 17, and this is the most critical problem of the bill, and it's why we think it's not workable, and essentially that they may incorporate pursuant to an ordinance enacted by a governing body of the local public health authority. This actually creates a statewide program and many other programs in the state, whether it's counties or otherwise. And so there's an infinite amount of regulation. And I sat on the Multnomah County Rulemaking Advisory Committee, and it was many, many hours. And we looked at so many data points and decisions to actually put together the rules. And I want to give credit to Multnomah County. I mean, I think I went into that process, skeptical, and I think we did a pretty good job. And so I went through that process, and now I'm looking at how many different decision points that all these different local public health authorities can make under a specific ordinance. This is something that my members, you know, just cannot support at all. And so you know, if we were to go back to those elements of 1559, I'm more than happy to have the discussion and understand the ability for local public health authorities to actually administer a statewide program, because that's exactly what Multnomah County would do if we would pass this. And so if there's a way that a program, and looking at how Multnomah County, and again, there's several different issues with the bill. If you just look on page 6 of the bill, there's a $5,000 per violation. Well, Multnomah County's rules start out much lower and go up to $1,000 on the fourth offense. And so it just gives you one example of just the variety of different things that anybody could do under this standard. And so, you know, again, I just want to emphasize, I would like to work with you on creating this program, but Senate Bill 235 goes in the absolute complete different direction. I was not part of the interim work group. I understand that the agencies before me sat in a room and created this, but this is unworkable as far as we can tell. And again, I'm sad to say that, because we support and want to work on a statewide license. And so I just wanted to share that with the committee. And again, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Mina Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent EC Blend, Valley Vapors, and select clients of the vaping industry. We oppose Senate Bill 234 in its current form, but let me be clear. Our clients are not against a reasonable, uniform statewide licensing program. Like Mr. Miller, we would argue that this is not a uniformed proposal. We have few issues with the bill in its current form, first being in Section 17, Subsection B, that allows each county to kind of implement their own rules. So main problem with that, I would have clients...
Which section?
Section 17, that allows the counties to incorporate their own licensing rules and regulations. So what we would have there is we would create a situation where I would have a client with a couple different locations and one licensing fee in one county with a separate set of rules, and then maybe a second location in a neighboring or a different county with a different licensing fee and another set of rules. You know, that poses a problem for us, and we would also like to see kind of a uniformed statewide fee as well, so we don't have different fees varying from different counties. Another issue we have with it is deals on the regulation side. So as written, it seems like one violation or one mistake could result in a revocation or a non-renewal of the license. So I have a business owner that's maybe at the coast one day and leaves the employee, and the employee's flustered, and God forbid forgets to check a state ID or puts the wrong product on the shelf. We could get a violation, and that violation could result in revocation or non-renewal of a license. We'd like to see that matrixed out, much like Marion County. I, too, served with Sean on the Marion County Rules Advisory Committee. And
Marion
that,
County or Multnomah County?
I'm sorry, Multnomah County. My apologies, Multnomah County. And we too were happy with that product. And the end result, but they did matrix out those fees. You know, one violation was a letter, one violation was then maybe a warning and then a fee, and it kind of matrixed out, and it allowed them, you know, to not threaten their license so much. And one thing I do want to put in a plug before I end and take any questions for Karen Gerard at the Oregon Health Authority. A lot of questions came up today about her fees and how she inspects. She did actually, when 2546 came out and the violation to sales to minors, she contacted me through the association and put on a nice presentation for us. We had about 30 or 40 shop owners, and she came out and showed us kind of what to do and how to stop the violations, and worked very well with us. So I wanted to put in a plug for her this morning.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Senator Moss Anderson. Rest of the committee. I'm here today as a small business owner. I own a very small vape shop out in Lebanon, Oregon. And
your name?
My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. And the reason I'm coming here today is reading this bill, I found just a few red flags. I have 11 employees at the time right now, and two of which are in between the ages of 18 and 21, also currently trying to purchase a home at the time, and are paying for it. So, you know, making very adult decisions. And these permitting bills, as far as the Tobacco 21, would basically make them lose their job. They wouldn't be allowed in my store after the Tobacco 21 would be passed. Another major issue that I found, as they were saying on Section 17, there was many. There's a patchwork of regulation where every county will be able to make their own rules. The largest red flag that I found with this bill is that any police officer that sees somebody that seemingly could be under the age of 18 or between 25 could be stopped and searched, seized, and harassed as not a citizen. I mean, we're American people. If you're 18 years old, between 21, and you're currently vaping, they have probable cause now because you're breaking the law, and so you can walk over there and they can harass you, according to that. So I feel I'm supportive in a regulation bill, 100%. I'm supportive in helping teenagers not smoke cigarettes anymore. I was a cigarette smoker at the age of 14 years old, and I struggled with that for 22 years. My only argument is maybe we could possibly put an amendment in excluding vape for 3 years, pending finding out, you know, it'll give those adults the option to have a safer alternative than to go back to traditional tobacco cigarettes that they might have probably just been most people, as you were told during the last session when we were hearing this, 90% of cigarette smokers start under the age of 18. We've already had a law in place for 18 and over only to purchase cigarettes for decades. So if 92% of people are smoking cigarettes before the age of 18 with these laws already in place, I think the true fact would be that they're getting them from their family and their relatives and friends in their home. It's not an issue where they're coming in with fake IDs. I personally aided my cigarette habit with my parents, and I could just take the cigarettes. My big argument here is possibly if we want to keep the tobacco out of the high school realm, we need to maybe bump the age to 19 and go across the board. And I know, as a vape shop owner, would be completely on board with that, because then it takes the high school element out of it altogether. There's no high school seniors over the age of 19. That would be the only argument, is which you guys, so to keep the tobacco out of the high school students. Again, and another option would be let's go and exempt vaping for 3 years so they have an alternative. You guys can get more information on the vaping industry. As you know, right now in the state, it's currently looking at to be taxed, but it's not at the time. And so I feel that, at this time, this bill would not work for us at all, being such a new industry as well. So thank you for your time.
Okay. Any comments?
If I may, Madam Chair, I'm really confused about this whole issue, because I couldn't quite tell, first of all, whether you were testifying about retail licensure or Tobacco 21, because it sounded like you were mostly testifying about 21 and this hearing is about TRL. So I was a little confused about that.
A little bit. Well, they kind of tied together last time where it was the open session, and I just, as far as, the licensure.
I was saying I was a little confused. I got really confused about your whole statement about police harassing people about that. I'm not sure where that's coming from or what the basis of that is, and I can assure you that we made crystal clear in the T21 bill that would not be an issue.
Okay.
And made it clear that would not qualify as probable cause, and that all they'd be allowed to do is confiscate products that people weren't allowed to own, and only the visible product. I mean, we were crystal clear in the language of that bill. So I'm not quite sure where you're concerned about the probable cause.
Well, we'll be discussing Tobacco 21 next Tuesday.
Absolutely. I just found that, to be slightly relative in the same circumstances. So, as far as, the income tax that each, my small business in this town 11, and I'm one of the very small vape shops in the state of Oregon, On a quarterly basis, I put in $7,400 quarterly, on average about $29,600 I pay in taxes right now currently. If you were to times that by conservatively the 250 vape shops that we have in the state of Oregon, that relatively comes out to about $7,400,000 yearly. Again, I have 11 employees. And they all make between $18,000 and $16,000 a year. That will bring back revenue and spending in my local community of $176,000 just in my town. And if you were to times that by 250 shops, along with the tax that my employees pay, which comes out to about $5,556 yearly, it's over $40 million in revenue that this vaping industry contributes to revenue in the state of Oregon. So that is a huge part. And as far as these licensure bills, we're a young industry, and if we have one violation, as he spoke of, then we go out of town and it's a $5,000 fine, which is the revenue of a complete month for some of these stores, a week for some also. But it's catastrophic. Not to mention they could lose their licensure on one issue that it's beyond their control.
Okay. Thank you. All right. With that, Christian Friend, Eric Brodo, and Carrie Nissom.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christopher Friend. I am the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'm here to speak today in support of SB 235 because every year 5,500 Oregon families lose a family member related to a tobacco death. Still today, tobacco remains the most preventable cause of death in our state, and ACS can support Senate Bill 235 because tobacco retail licensing is a critically important tool to enforce public health policy across the state. And to regulate business that sells tobacco products to ensure that they comply with tobacco laws and to combat the public health problems that tobacco causes. ACS CAN supports SB 235 because it sets a minimum standard of licensing across the state, which protects young people in counties which lack the resources to pass and enforce their own retail license program. Furthermore, SB 235 is supported by ACS CAN because it empowers local leaders to pass stronger standards for which they know is best for their own communities. Additionally, ACS CAN supports the legislation because it would require inhalant delivery system retailers to also obtain a license to sell the products. According to a 2015 National Youth Survey, over 2.3 million high school students and over 620,000 middle school students currently use e-cigarettes. Evidence shows that tobacco retail licensing is a solid implement to ensure tobacco products and e-cigarettes remain out of the hands of young people. Finally, we believe that the proposed fee is fair and a sustainable source of funding to administer and enforce the program. As an organization that's dedicated to keeping Oregonians healthy and cancer-free, ACS strongly supports SB 235. Yes, 235. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. Hello, and thank you for allowing me to address you today about Senate Bill 235, Tobacco Retail Licensure. My name is Eric Brodell, and I live on Kirby Avenue in Portland. I am the Western Region Director for Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation and Tobacco 21. We provide assistance across the country to support strong tobacco control laws that prevent youth initiation in drafting and implementing both state and local laws. Two main areas that have been of major importance in the past decade are minimum legal sales age laws and tobacco retail licensing. To be effective, youth access laws must be rigorously enforced. Unfortunately, youth access laws are often poorly enforced. The National Monitoring the Future survey reports that two-thirds of 10th grade students found cigarette access to be fairly easy or very easy. Additionally, Oregon does not require a tobacco retail license to sell tobacco, and therefore a comprehensive list of tobacco retailers is currently not available. While Oregon's underage tobacco sales compliance rates are within acceptable reporting levels, out of almost 3,000 known retailers, only 426 were inspected through the SINAR program last year. While this is considered a representative sample of tobacco retailers in Oregon, it's very hard to believe that the results truly represent the rate of underage sales in the state today, when not even every county has a compliance check done annually. A federally mandated program is simply not enough to ensure that Oregon's tobacco retailers are participating in responsible retailing practices, including, but not limited to, not selling to underage buyers, posting appropriate signage, and displaying tobacco products properly. Moreover, retailers caught selling to underage buyers are assessed a fine and a Class A violation under the current system. Oftentimes, these fines are so small that they make no impact on a seller's business, and they will continue to sell to minors regardless of the amount of violations they accrue. An effective tobacco retail licensing system ensures greater compliance among tobacco retailers through suspension and eventual revocation of tobacco retail license if enough violations are accrued in the course of a year or more. Representative fines and increased responsibility on retail establishment owners instead of the clerks also help to strengthen compliance. There's evidence in tobacco retail licensure working around the country. In Philadelphia, tobacco retail licensing has improved retailer compliance through the risk of suspension and revocation of licenses and decreased retailer density in residential areas, concentrated mainly in low-income communities. Strong tobacco control policies concentrate on youth prevention. Enforcement of those policies ensures compliance and decreased initiation of use. We license both alcohol and marijuana sales for these very same reasons. It's only logical to bring tobacco, the number one cause of preventable death, into that licensing structure to ensure our youth's healthy futures. Thank you for considering this life-saving policy that will protect thousands of Oregon youth.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I serve as the Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Oregon, and I'm here today to strongly support Senate Bill 235. I support this not only as a professional, but also personally. A year ago in November, I watched my dad take his last breath after a decades-long battle of COPD, and I also have a young nephew who struggles with tobacco addiction, so it's very real. This legislation is all about our kids. It's about putting evidence-based practices into place to discourage the use of tobacco products for our youth. We know what works to lower smoking rates and to delay initiation and use of tobacco products by our youth. We have the science and we have the evidence to put into place policies that work. The Lung Association every year issues a report called the State of Tobacco Control Report. And this report provides grades in five policy areas for states. And each of these policy areas are evidence-based and have demonstrated success when states put them into use. It's not just one policy or strategy that we need to put into place to reduce tobacco's effect in our states. We need to take a comprehensive approach to address this public health issue. Over 23% of Oregon's high school youth use tobacco, over 8% of our high school youth smoke, and over 17% use electronic smoking devices. We should strive for these percentages to be zero. We can and should do more to prevent youth from using tobacco. And again, it takes a comprehensive approach, and retail licensing is one of these evidence-based policies that we should be implementing. Licensing helps to identify all business selling tobacco to consumers and communities. It aids in the enforcement of existing retailer laws, and it provides better control and will lead to better compliance of current laws. As my colleague Christopher said, tobacco remains the number one cause of preventable death and disease in Oregon, and it costs our state nearly $3 billion per year in medical costs and lost productivity. Comprehensive tobacco control policies, including retail licensure, will help drive down healthcare costs as fewer of our youth use tobacco products and will also aid in creating a healthier Oregon.
Thank you very much. And now let's call up April Fisher, Jason Weber, and J.L. Wilson. And I'd like to be done in I want Kosasan and Kowling to bring up the last, they'll be the last two. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and committee. My name is April Fisher. I am representing myself as a business owner of a vapor shop, actually two, in Southern Oregon. And I am testifying basically against this SB 235, as I have one vapor store in Josephine County and my other one's in Jackson County. As testified before by other people, as far as a licensure bill, we're not against that, but it would be more of a statewide versus individual counties that would be not only detrimental to, you know, just being a paperwork, you know, I mean, you guys know about paperwork, but also trying to comply with all of these different places. If there was one standard, then I could understand doing that. But having to go, you know, different counties. Also the fact of if one person makes a mistake, then all of a sudden, boom, your livelihood is gone, you know, because you decided you were going to take a couple days off from your shop. And just I won't go into the T21 just because that's a different bill.
Be
so,
next week.
Yeah, that'll be next week. But thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and committee. My name is Jason Weber. I'm also just representing myself as a vape shop owner. I own a vape shop in Roseburg, Oregon. Very small business. I am opposed to the way the bill is written as of right now. However, my wife and I are not completely opposed to a licensing bill at all. And I agree with keeping kids off of tobacco. As I mentioned before, we are not tobacco. We are a 95% safer solution, and we do not agree with kids vaping either. We have a rule in our vape shop where our employees make sure to card anyone who looks under 30 years old. However, you can't always stop everything. Sometimes, you know, kids are smart. They might walk in with their brother's ID or something like that. And so the thing we're worried about the most is if someone does get by us, or again, if we're on vacation or something, you have a rogue employee or maybe someone who's really new and green. If they are to drop the ball on that, then I mean, a $5,000 fine would put me out of business because I am a small business owner, and also not being able to get a chance to get our license back, that would definitely be detrimental to our business. So I guess that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson representing 7-Eleven stores. There's 141 7-Eleven stores throughout the state. I think I need to put something on the record because it kind of feels like it's being portrayed as the Wild West out there. But with regard to 7-Eleven stores and tobacco sales and retail sales, I mean, it is part of, we take it so seriously that it's part of the franchise agreement. We operate the We Card Under 18 program. We spend enormous corporate resources training franchisees and their employees to detect minors trying to sell, to card them, to identify them, because we do take it so seriously. In fact, it's such a part of our platform that a franchisee does, in fact, run the risk of losing their franchise if there are two violations. And so it is built into the corporate culture of 7-Eleven to take this issue very seriously. For the record, we do not oppose a statewide retail licensure system. The Senate Bill 1559 of 2 years ago, we probably could have gotten there but for an issue of takings that was in the bill that had to do with how close these stores were to schools. And there was also the issue of treating the small stores differently from the big stores. And I know that must not have been that important because these elements aren't in Senate Bill 235. So it's just to demonstrate we were, I felt, on a path to get to a statewide retail licensure through DOR, which is something in principle that we agreed with. I agree with Mr. Miller's testimony with the grocers prior to mine that now we're in a position of being whipsawed between state and local government, and potentially three different agencies. You've got your local government, your OHA, and DOR. You're paying fees to all three under this measure, and the fees are indeterminate to be set by rule. There's no there's no guidelines or structures as to what somebody could expect.
Just a clarification
on that.
Ma'am. It is a one fee to DOR. It just depends on which jurisdiction you're in as to what the amount of the fee would be.
Thank you. And to your point, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think that that would have to be clarified because Section 5 clearly contemplates fees to DOR. Section 14 clearly contemplates fees to OHA, and then that's on top of your fees to the local government. And I know that this bill is meant to accommodate local government regulation in addition to state regulation because Section 5 basically preconditions a DOR license on adherence to local regulations. And that's a long way from where I felt we were 2 years ago. So at this stage, if this is how it is, I would have to say from our members' point of view, we'd probably be better off with a patchwork of local regulations, although we don't think that that is the right outcome or the best outcome, but that's just where we are as it relates to this bill in its current form. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could, Madam
yes.
Chair,
mm-hmm.
just one clarification, Mr. Wilson. You could have a state, county and city, so you could have three different licensing formulas in place. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Richard Kosasan and Morgan Kelling, and that's all I have on my list. So hopefully, there is no one else out there that wants to testify. Okay.
Are we together?
And
we
I want Richard to go first, go and Morgan to bring up be the last one.
Oh, ladies first.
Madam Chair, Richard Kosasan, and I represent the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which has been around for the better part of 15 years. And it was started to focus and try to advocate the interests of small convenience stores throughout the state of Oregon. I think you've heard most of the concerns, but very briefly with Senate Bill 235, we have, as Senator Cruz alluded to, licensing through the Department of Revenue, but very clearly with the other provisions, specifically those delineated in Section 17, you have perhaps an additional licensing provision through a city or county or a local health authority. The measure, as drafted and currently structured, basically maintains no caps on the fees, whether it be through the Department of Revenue, through the health authority, or the local level, and those are on top of each other. And again, I think one of the concerns is the lack of structure. Those fees basically are delineated and identified through administrative rule without any type of limitation. As structured, we believe the bill actually encourages a duplication of programs through the state level and again through the local level. As mentioned earlier, enforcement penalties. There really is no enforcement penalty schedule. Section 7, literally as written, one inadvertent violation, not just of the provisions of this measure, but the provisions of any state law, any federal law, rule or regulation, any provision of a local ordinance or any rule associated with the local ordinance, someone with an inadvertent violation may lose their license or jeopardize their license. We believe that is just a little bit too severe. To address that, we would encourage strongly the committee to take a look at the schedule and use as a schedule and a starting point the schedule outlined currently under the FDA Tobacco Control Act federally. And they outline a very, I think, well thought out, well delineated schedule, basically recognizing one violation may occur. That deserves a warning letter. And your second violation, you're into civil penalties. And on top of it, if you have someone in the retail community who is, quote, a bad actor, The federal government now has instituted a system of no sale. So they basically can go to a retailer and say, you're not going to sell tobacco products, period. The bill, I don't think, lacks, well, it as structured, I think it lacks a couple of things. We have in Oregon inspections of retailers through the Federal Drug Administration. We have the administration of inspections through the Oregon Health Authority for purposes of the 1992 SINAR Amendment. And I believe the Oregon Health Authority does additional inspections. We have local inspections, and we have Department of Revenue inspections for purposes of tax compliance. To me, those should all be coordinated. And again, if we move forward, we believe we could use the FDA program as a starting point, as a framework, and work from there. But all those programs should be coordinated. I think there's a better way. One, before we get to the better way, though, I would encourage a very serious look at enforcement of existing laws. We have laws endangering the welfare of a minor associated with tobacco. We have requirements for signage. We have requirements for the location of product in a store. I believe in 2003, this body decided that we were going to follow some of the then trends and basically prohibit any location of product that did not require a one-to-one interchange between a retailer and a customer. We have requirements for and prohibiting the possession of tobacco by minors. We have on the books prohibitions in terms of minors being able to access or purchase. We've outlawed vending machines in terms of locations, any location open to the public. We have umpteen laws through the Department of Revenue in terms of delivery sales. We have provisions dealing with public instruction. I think the first question that everybody should get to, irrespective of what side of the debate they're on, is do we fail completely to enforce what we have on the books? But in terms of a better alternative, if we deem a licensing structure or a registration structure is important and significant, we could set up a licensing registration system through the Department of Revenue. I'd like to correct a previous speaker suggesting that the Department of Revenue lacked information. I think currently the Department of Revenue maintains a database of about 4,200 retailers in the state that sell tobacco. They have a pretty good idea of who is out there. In terms of penalties, we could set up a matrix. We could also coordinate the programs from the federal level to the state level through the Department of Revenue and through the Oregon Health Department. And do a better job with public education and outreach. The $64,000 question is the control of local governments. If we set up a uniform statewide effective program, to me, we might not need the local programs. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
No, we're going to keep going, Morgan, because we have one more bill after this.
Great.
But stay there.
Thank you, Senator Montes Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Cowling, the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, working with and on behalf of the 34 local health departments throughout Oregon that currently run tobacco prevention programs and conduct restaurant inspections. I'm here to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 235. And first, I would like to thank Senator for holding this hearing today and remind the committee of a little bit of our history in tobacco control. As recent as 2013, Oregon had a huge problem with the sale of tobacco to minors. Our SINAR rates were over 20%, which put us at risk for losing the block grant. Since 2013, the Oregon Health Authority, as was previously mentioned, has done a lot to consolidate programs, the FDA program, the CYNAR program, and the state police, all under the Public Health Division. In addition, since 2013, we've had Lane County and cities within Lane County and Multnomah County pass local tobacco retail licenses. So there's been quite a bit of work to try and reduce those CYNAR rates. And while we've made some improvements in youth access, there's still a lot to be done. And I'd like to talk a little bit about why this bill, as structured, is an important piece, because it really is about coordination. And, you know, I think that a lot has been done since we were here last session, especially with Multnomah County's local ordinance. And at its core, what this bill is trying to do is better coordinate the work at the Multnomah County, the work at the Oregon Health Authority, and the work at the Department of Revenue. So this bill has four major components. One is that it is one license issued through the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue would collect the fees, and yes, they would be different community to community, but there would be one central point where local retailers would go. Last session, there were some discussions about which agency should be the lead, and we really tried to keep as few agencies as possible, and Department of Revenue, because of their work on tax compliance, did seem like a natural place to start. The second major piece is streamlining enforcement. As I mentioned, OHA has consolidated the CYNAR and FDA within the Public Health Division, and the information sharing, which is written into this bill between OHA and local public health authorities and DOR, will help ensure that retailer checks are coordinated. The third piece is that this does allow for a self-sustaining program. As Karen mentioned, I believe the FDA, the contract with the FDA has expired. So while we've made a lot of progress, we're potentially losing resources. So we need to make sure that the fees are such to cover the cost of doing education and training and the enforcement actions.
But that is up to each local jurisdiction.
Each jurisdiction, no agency wanted to be responsible for setting fees for the other agency, so each agency needs to determine the cost of their part of the program. And then the Department of Revenue would collect on behalf of all. So the retailer would only go to one place, but covering the cost may be different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Like DOR says it'll be $25 to just do their piece. Multnomah County is $580. Lane County is $200. Just for the record right now.
And Department of Revenue would collect, the retailer would just go to one place, the Department of Revenue, and they would have the information, and they would just pay the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue would be responsible for the agreements to transfer those funds.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Do we know why we lost the contract at the federal level?
Chairman is Anderson, Senator Knope. I do not have that information, but I can follow up with the agency. The fourth point that is
OHA, do you know why we lost? To answer the question, can you just come up here? You can stay there, Richard, in case there's just one more question.
Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Knope, OHA will reapply for the contract when it becomes available again. As I mentioned before, this bill does contain a technical fix that is pretty important to having a strong contract with the FDA.
And I'm sorry, what is that element?
Senate Bill 235 allows other state employees other than the state police to be commissioned officers for the FDA.
Proceed.
Thank you.
Are you almost
Yep, I'm on that. So two last points. Local public health authorities are uniquely positioned to be able to do the local front-end education and training with retailers and enforcement. As I mentioned, we already have environmental health specialists that work with local businesses and restaurants in the community. And after a discussion with Multnomah County and Lane County, that is how they are currently beginning their programs and would use those existing community resources. And the last piece is that the way we have structured this, there would, as Karen mentioned, be that coordination and oversight by the Oregon Health Authority so that we could make sure that this was happening across all parts of the state. So with that, I really do want to encourage this committee to pass on Senate Bill 235 and so that we can have better coordination amongst the many, the couple of agencies that need to be a part of this work.
Okay, any quick questions for any three? Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 217. Oliver and then Senator Roblin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 217, the measure adds chiropractic and naturopathic physicians to the types healthcare professionals in Oregon authorized to issue a medical release specific to athletes who have experienced a sports-related concussion. We have not received any amendments, and testimony is available on old list.
Senator Robum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Monis Anderson, and Vice Chair, Senator Cruz. There will be amendments, and I appreciate the opportunity to have the hearing and then have a conversation about what's going on. And a number of the people who have been in a work group that's been going on for a while are in the audience and I think would like to testify. This goes back to Max's Law a number of years ago, and at the time Max's Law was passed, and you'll hear testimony from people who were instrumental in getting that passed, we had a group of medical professionals who were available to meet with a student and then authorize them to be able to play after a concussion protocol was done. In 2013, we changed that and took out some of those medical professionals, chiropractors in particular. I think that happened, I think OSA was a lot of different groups of people involved, many of the same ones that are here today. And it became clear to me that there were issues that needed to be have real conversations about it. And I want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for spending some time with me and explaining different things and actually meeting with other people and helping bring together all the different people that needed to be there. And you'll hear from a lot of them because actually through that conversation, we may actually extend it to more medical professionals than we originally did in Max's Law if it is the desire of this group. And I think the amendments will show that. The issue is we want to make sure that students are returned to play with adequate information on the person who is looking them in the eye and making a determination of whether their concussion is resolved and whether they should be able to play again. And I think everybody in the group feels the same way about that. That's a common concern. Number two, one of the aspects of Max's Law that I think got lost in a couple of the conversations was that in Max's situation, the only people they could sue happened to be the school district because there wasn't this protocol in place before. And they have a cap on their liability of about $200,000. And this was a tragic accident that has left that person with a lifelong care facility. And that $200,000 did not suffice to help that. And you can hear some of that later. So,
and what year was the $200,000? A long time ago.
Max's Law passed in 2009.
Yes, it was just before that.
So it was just before that.
Okay, thank you.
2007. And that was a general cap for public schools, other kinds of things, and they sued the school district and the coach and whatever in that particular situation. So that was they got the maximum, but that was it. So in our conversations that have been going on since last time, and we've had a group pulled together, and I, again, want to thank Senator Steiner-Hywood because I would not have thought of all the people we actually got into the room, and I guess being a medical professional, you understand there's all these other groups out there. So we brought everybody together to start having a conversation about it. And interestingly enough, we have come a long way since Max's Law with respect to concussion protocols. And there are people at OHSU currently who are working on training on protocols. We have a concussion protocol committee out there that is working all at different times. And so knowing all of those things, and Senator Snyder, I could talk to it more than I could on those things, we are getting a better and better understanding that probably not all people who are currently able have had the most recent information on it. But what we're looking at doing, because in Max's original law, the issue was, can we make sure that the people who are making the decision to put a person back into the game have something in the game? And that means liability insurance or others that exceed the cap that is in the school district. So, and as many as we can possibly have, because our state is diverse, and not every place in our state has the medical professionals of one kind or another that are necessary to make those decisions. And so what you're going to see in the amendments, and I wish I could say to you that it was a unanimous group for the whole group, but it is not. And I think you may hear today is that some people did not come to that same conclusion that others have, that we want to put in place a requirement that anyone making the decision to send a person back has gone through the latest protocols and learns the best available science with regard to what they should be looking for, what questions they should be asking, and how they should make the decision on allowing that person to play. We want that best science to be in whoever professionals are going to do it. So we've worked with chiropractors, worked with naturopaths, we've worked with athletic trainers, all of those different groups of people, nurses. And so currently the way the bill is being framed, the amendments are being framed, is that we will open the criteria of which medical professionals can, in fact, do this to another group, and you'll hear from them a little later. But two conditions. One, they have to have liability insurance of up to $1 million. Number two, they need to have gone through the training for these new protocols, which we are going to, in the bill, in the amendments, we're going to set aside to another professional group to identify and make the protocols. And that every 3 years, as new protocols are developed and new information is developed, every 3 years they're going to have to renew. And for the introduction of this, as we go into this, what we're going to say is those people who are currently able to make that decision will continue at least for an extra year to be available. And anyone who wants to add from these other groups that wants to get a license to be able to do that is going to have to go through those protocols. At the end of that year, all professionals who want to do it are going to need to go through the protocols. That way, we don't leave in a lurch kids having an opportunity to have someone to reassess them and make them go back. And at the same time, ease in this all these new protocols to all professionals that are going to make decisions like that. And it gives us a chance to watch and see how many people sign up to do it, who's going to be available to it. But from my perspective, it takes care of the two issues that we need to take care of. One, that the people making a determination have the latest, best information about going through a concussion protocol. Number two, that there is something there to help in those unfortunate examples when somebody goes back and there's something else that happens that they can look to for recourse for the family. And that's what you're going to get to see.
And can we have the whole panel, or do you really want to get a question out to him?
Just him. Okay. He's working on a minute. Would this apply, the certification and the course, would that apply to all of the professionals that are authorized under this statute?
Yes. Eventually. As the transition goes, we've got to get the thing in place. We've got to get people trained, and we hope this will be online. We expect that it will be. And at the end of the following year, all professionals, including the ones that are currently grandfathered for the first year.
Hmm. Let's start. We're running. I just want to.
Yep.
Bring them on up. Stay around, but yeah, I really want to get the speakers through.
Yep.
Dr. Ted Folkham, Laura LaJoy, and Sherry Stock Morris. It will be coming back when we have the amendment, so we'll be able to get into more depth. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman and committee members. I'm Dr. Laura LaJoy. I'm a chiropractor in Wilsonville and have been in practice for 23 years. Got my doctorate of chiropractic at the University of Western States in 1993 and have been in private practice ever since. Since arriving in Wilsonville in 1995, I have been the team physician for the high school for any sport from football to the equestrian team and everyone in between. It's been on a voluntary basis, so my personal malpractice insurance has been applied if it was ever necessary. Thank God it hasn't been. But I've also worked quite a bit with professional sports, women's pro beach volleyball, men's pro beach volleyball, semi-pro men's soccer, and then all the way down to youth football, soccer, and basketball, men's and women's. I've done a tremendous amount of training in sports medicine, and with that comes concussion. Part of the reason that it's so important to us as chiropractors to be included in this law is that on a daily basis, our core competency requires that we're able to assess concussion. When you consider the number of people that we see in motor vehicle injuries, work comp, slip and fall, kids that fall off the playground onto their head, many times a day, we're making sure if that person has a concussion or not. And so having a student athlete come in to assess for concussion is just a natural segue in that same care. I've had a couple of cases in the last year where I'm on the sideline of the football game, varsity football player goes down no farther from you than me, and I'm the first one on the scene because our trainer is down the line with another kid with an injury. I can call the concussion, I keep him out of the game, and because I've been working with varsity sports for so long, I have office hours on Saturday morning, so I'm the first one to then assess that kid the next morning. He then has to wait until he can get an appointment with his pediatrician in order to go back to play as we're coming into state playoffs. His parents had me continue with his care because there was also a whiplash injury that occurred at the same time, and so I was treating him for the whiplash injury, called the concussion return to play protocol, but had to wait for the clearance from the pediatrician. A year ago, my own daughter, I have three teenage daughters who are all athletes, went to her pediatrician as was required by this Jenna's law. She is a soccer player, took a ball point blank to the face and had a concussion. Within 10 minutes, the athletic trainer was on the scene. Within an hour, she was assessed in my office. And it took us 10 days before she could be seen by the pediatrician because of her schedule. Even though this was something critical, I knew based on my experience, as did the trainer, that it wasn't, you know, a traumatic brain injury, but in the classification of concussion. So 10 days later, she saw the pediatrician, whose primary demographic is under the age of 10 years old, not a 15-year-old, 6-foot female athlete. Not only was she using a SCAT-2 exam form, but the SCAT-3 had been updated for 2 years already, and she's using the old protocols, having to read from the form, not familiar with it because that's not her daily activity. So in our daily activity, we're seeing these chiropractors, just like medical professionals who are specialists in what they do. We do tremendous amount of continuing education within the field of sports medicine, knowing that there's a tremendous amount of responsibility related to concussion specifically, and that the return to play protocols have to be coordinated not only with the physician, with the athletic trainer, and with the coach, but also communicated effectively with the parents. And we've agreed in our work group that the certification is a necessary guideline for all professionals across the board because it brings together the international guidelines as they're set out every 4 years when they're in Zurich or Geneva. So with that, I'd like to say, you know, the responsibility is huge. We don't take it lightly. The liability is important. Again, we don't take that lightly. And as a work group, we've worked hard on making sure that everyone who is included in this bill understands that the core competency, the up-to-date certification, the inclusion of the providers that are well-trained and certified, and that the liability is included. Thank you.
And from a chiropractor's point of view, and I don't know if you can speak for all of them, when we include athletic trainers, what are their core competencies to send
I don't know exactly, but I do know from the trainers that I work with at Wilsonville High School that part of their core competency is that not only are they trained in the assessment evaluation of concussion, but they also do impact testing in most of the schools now prior to the contact sports initiating their season. In our case, the pediatrician told my daughter on a Wednesday that if she followed these three criteria, she could be going back to return to play protocols on Monday. The trainer's the one that was eye to eye with her every day and didn't actually release her for another 2 weeks without her having to go back to the pediatrician because she'd already given her a preliminary release.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ted Forkum. I live in practice in Portland, Oregon. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 217, and thank you, Senators, for your time and attention here today on this. I consider this a very important subject. It's nice for me to be down here on a sunny day. I used to go to school right there, and I didn't see too many sunny days while I was there.
Neither did I.
Neither did I.
So you can appreciate that statement. I sustained a head injury myself, actually, as an athlete running cross-country. I know you don't think of cross-country as a contact sport, but actually I was hit by a flagpole, and I was unconscious at the state championship. We went from a victory to third place on our team, and even though I still finished covered in blood, I don't remember the last 600 meters of the race. What I do recall from that experience, outside of a really bad headache and some disappointment in our team finish, is that there's a great deal of inconsistency in terms of the care that I received between the ATC, the EMT, at the ER, and then my follow-up with my MD. And I think what we're looking at here is trying to establish some consistency in how return-to-play recommendations are made. Also, as you can see, this is a big topic to me. I was involved with supporting the Oregon helmet law as well. To give you a little bit of my background, I kind of thought of some of my background that's salient where I've had experience with concussion in events. My practice is maybe a little bit different than many. I was medical staff with the Pan American Games in Rio in 2007. I was also medical staff for the U.S. Olympic team in 2008 in Beijing. I worked with USA Taekwondo Championships as their run-up to the 1992 Olympics. As a medical director for U.S. Soccer Festival, I worked for the Portland Timbers for a stint. I also worked with arena football, indoor football, X-game adventure races, which are kind of like a jailbreak. oddly, the PGA Tour and senior, or I like to say Champions Tour, we've seen concussions in that event. And as you can imagine, you know, people get hit by golf balls and stray clubs. And we actually had one of our staff members who got a concussion from getting hit by a wad of turf by Bill Murray as he chipped a shot. I'm serious. It kind of took this guy off his feet, standing right next to him. So I feel very fortunate that I don't have to live that down for the rest of my life because we remind him daily. I was also a medical director for USA Figure Skating. I've worked with the USA Track and Field National Championships, Olympic Trials, and the World Team in 2015. I currently work for the Portland Winterhawks. I consulted at the Rio Olympics this last time around, and I'm a board member on the Joint Commission on Sports Injuries, the Joint Commission on Sports Medicine and Science, which this is a salient topic for, and a topic that we have also the same viewpoint as what Senate Bill 217 is projecting. The Joint Commission contains all healthcare professions involved in sports throughout U.S. and Canada, going from the people who test helmets, the Olympic Committee, the NC2A, the high school associations, as well as ophthalmologists, optometrists, dentists, chiropractors, MDs, etc. So this has been an ongoing topic that we've had, and we've had experts from around the world that have came in and presented to us on this subject. There are several things that are known, and I think there's, by those experts' own admission, more things that are unknown in the realm of concussion. I believe our best interest is to capitalize on what we do know or is our prevailing thought and develop a standard of care for the process of treating concussion as well as return to play protocol. If we go back in time and kind of look at people who evaluated concussion in the past, and I think that some of our classic goes back to the New Jersey Boxing Commission, because they saw more fights in the U.S. in boxing than any other state in the country for many years. Going back to the Ali Foreman era, the two ringside doctors, one was a gynecologist, the other was a chiropractor. And granted, the training wasn't optimal for a gynecologist in terms of concussion protocol. It comes down to taking a person, educating them on what's the primary features, and developing a standard. And I think that's very important. In terms of our profession as chiropractors, our last two medical directors for the U.S. Olympic Committee were chiropractors, Mike Reed and Bill Moreau. And matter of fact, Bill Moreau was the chief medical officer for the Olympics overall in Rio. So I think that, you know, that says a lot for the capability of our profession and what we see day in, day out, in terms of we see a lot of concussion. Concussion also has a lot of symptoms that mimic other conditions and vice versa, such as cervical whiplash, TMJ syndrome, a variety of other myofascial conditions will also mimic concussion. And to treat everyone as if they have a concussion and ignore the other components also can be hampering or hinder the progression of care. In this terms of Senate Bill 217, I really think
you're
going
to have to hurry. Yep. I'm losing people. Yeah.
I think it's very important that we develop that standard of return to play protocol. Thank you.
Jerry.
I'll try and be very fast. So, Chair Amanis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and Senator Steiner Haywood. My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. I'm on the Governor's Task Force, Traumatic Brain Injury Task Force. And I literally wrote Max's Law. And it was a much stronger law when I wrote it initially, and it got a lot taken out because I wasn't going to let a kid go back to play for a year. They didn't approve of that. But in it, in Max's Law, there was it said that they would go to a medical professional. And that was because, yeah, Max Conrad, when he was knocked out, he only had the $200,000 from the school. Max is now on living in assisted living. He'll be there the rest of his life. And Senator Manis Anderson, I know you've met him. But he's at about a second grade level, and he's never gotten above that, and he never will. And so he's actually on state rolls. So we're paying, all taxpayers are paying for Max. And so if there had been some sort of recourse rather than sending him back in, he might not be where he is right now. We would hope that he wouldn't be. And the idea is to not let other people. With Jenna's Law, Jenna's doctor came with us and helped us with creating Jenna's Law. And that was a chiropractic physician, Bonnie Malone, out of Sisters. And Senator Knopp knows Bonnie. And and that's still Jenna's doctor today. And Jenna is functioning. She's married, now has a family, by the way.
Oh, she does?
Yeah. And she has a thriving ranch, but she wouldn't be, she was in a fetal position in the ER. And that was from skiing, multiple concussions in skiing. And doctors would send her right back in. One of the reasons we had all medical professionals with Max's Law is because medical professionals have medical liability insurance. They have malpractice insurance, which is really important. So a kid might be return to play, but the doctor might say they're fine to go in, and then the athletic trainer is approving that because they're approving the doctor's orders. And so it isn't on the athletic trainer per se, it's on the doctor. And so if the doctor tells them to go in too soon and the athletic trainer follows that and sends them in, it's not the athletic trainer that is ultimately responsible for that error, it's the doctor, and they have the medical malpractice. But also, this has been a discussion in Senator Steiner Hayward's part of her plan, as Senator Roblin was talking about. But also, the last thing I want to say is I know this isn't the end, and I know things are constantly changing, but Dr. Jim Chestnut has been working for quite a while on creating this online concussion training, and he plans to have it done by the end of the summer, maybe October. And so we're hoping to roll that out and have everybody training with that and then constantly update it, because there's changes all the time.
Thank you. And we won't have questions because we're going to have it back when we get the amendments back. So with that, Sam Johnson, Courtney Dresser, and Nan Heim, and that will be it. Let's have Sam start it off and Courtney and Nan ending it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'll keep it very brief. My name is Sam Johnson. I'm a faculty member in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University and also part of the athletic training education program there. I'm also the president of the Oregon Athletic Trainer Society. We believe that if the list of medical providers is to be expanded, that athletic trainers deserve to be on that list. If you look at our role, we collaborate with physicians to prevent, recognize, and evaluate injuries and provide immediate care and rehabilitation, including return-to-play decisions. If you look at our core competencies in athletic training, the current ones related to concussion, brain injuries, and return-to-play, there are at least 7 core competencies related to that. In my written testimonies, I provided the proposed 2016, the new competencies that will come out that are referenced directly to brain injury and concussion. The Oregon Athletic Training Practice Act currently requires athletic trainers to obtain continuing education on concussion or traumatic brain injury every 3 years. So we support further training that's being developed through Dr. Chestnut's group at OHSU. And at least 30 other states recognize athletic trainers to make return to play following concussions. And then lastly, from a practical standpoint, when we look about access, the athletic trainers are in the schools. They know these kids. As Dr. LaJoy pointed out, we athletic trainers will hold them back if they're not ready. And that's just what we've always done. I mean, we've constantly, it's in the practice act as far as we collaborate with other physicians, but we've always referred to specialists when needed. So to keep it brief, I'll leave it there.
Thank you. So you do have really extensive training, because I know, you think of an athletic trainer and you don't realize the training, probably better training than a pediatrician or, who knows what other physician that doesn't have that particular specialty. So I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and we have some concerns with Senate Bill 2217. Untreated and mistreated concussions in athletes can cause some serious injury and death, or death, which is why we take this very seriously. We do believe that all provider types, many that you've heard from today, play a very important role in a young athlete's well-being. Athletic trainers, volunteer health care providers that participate in game day care, providers that help get injured players back to playing shape are all important components for a collaborative approach to student athletes' well-being. So we do have concerns with expanding this. We do believe that a training is necessary. And I know some of my members won't always be happy about that, but we do believe that there needs to be an enhanced training for the providers that currently serve ready to play. And we're excited to hear what Dr. Chestnut is working on. We're excited to see OHSU involved in that, and think that is very important because the science is changing rapidly on this. So we would encourage that this legislation kind of stop there, that it has the training and development, that the task force, the governor's task force, is in charge of making sure that happens. And then we work to get the providers that currently can do return to play trained up and get the standard of practice within that community settled and that gap of care taken care of before we move forward and adding more providers to
so
this.
So you're opposed to chiropractic, naturopathic physicians and athletic trainers being put in the bill?
Correct.
Thank you.
Um, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Association of Orthopedic Surgeons. Our members include a number of sports orthopedists who work with teams of practitioners all around the state caring for young athletes. We have not taken a position yet. We're having, I would describe, very robust conversations among our members. Some of them met, talked last night, for example, with Dr. Chestnut, who is, in fact, a member of our association and very well respected. We share some of the concerns that Courtney has alluded to, although I have heard from our members respect for the other practitioners working in the fields that they work in. I would say the overriding concern our members have expressed to me so far is that whether a course, an online course, even one done by Dr. Chestnut, is adequate neurological training to provide what they see as concussion management.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, everyone. This will be coming back. I'm not sure when, but as soon as we have a good amendment that all parties can have, I'd like you to be, everyone to be seeing the amendment. So as soon as we get it and the stakeholders agree to the changes, then we'll put it publicly so we'll have these organizations be able to look at it before we come to committee to actually discuss it. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 217, and we're adjourned.
See you in the morning.
And I bolt off.
In the morning.
And I bolt off. 19, and we're adjourned.